afternoon, everybody. This is Robin Ayu from the Localization Fireside Chat, your favorite podcaster. I want to welcome you for another episode. Today, we are recording episode 125 on the channel, and I'm honored to have with me Pascal Tremblay. And Pascal is a Canadian who lives in the U.S. with dual citizenship. Pascal has been an active voice in the industry everywhere you turn. On social media, when it comes to our industry, you see Pascal's name, Pascal's opinion. And she has several area that we want to cover today. One of them in particular, it was related to a conversation or a podcast that we did in, and I published on October 9th with Sylvia Salabarde from Vancouver, from CITIC. And this is where we covered the story about that individual who was, just as a reminder for everybody, that individual who was in a situation where they had to interact with the police did not, she did not speak English, she was speaking Spanish, and the police did not understand what she was talking about. They used Google Translate on their equipment to be able to back and forth with that individual. Unfortunately, that situation ended up with this, with a tragedy. You guys can Google the rest of it, the details of the case. But from a language perspective, we were interested in it because it expressed the area where we were not able to communicate. And the industry came together in terms of trying to figure out, could we have to answer the question, could we have done better? Could we facilitate a better communication? Not necessarily in this particular case, but in cases in the future where similar situation are finding themselves in society, etc. Pascal, welcome to the conversation. I think this is the first one-on-one together. I really appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time. As we say on this channel, Pascal, everybody's got a story. I'm going to have to ask you the question. Tell me your story.
Thank you, Robin, it's an honor to be here and to be discussing a topic that is very dear to my heart. If we think about these barriers in communication and we look at Canada as a bilingual country, and you raise that question, how are we finding ourselves in such situations when we have an infrastructure in place and we should not, we should be better than this? Well, it strikes a chord for me because as a French Canadian, I grew up in French in a region that is mostly predominantly French. I mean, until recently, it's Saguenay-Lac-Saint-Jean and it's very French. And I wanted to share because part of my experience as a French Canadian was to see, even at a young age, how language changed some of the behavior and impacted our families and my parents' generation. So for those who might not be familiar with the situation in Canada, language was often used as a way to segregate First Nations, but also segregate French speakers. So in a region like Saguenay-Lac-Saint-Jean, until the 70s, when there was that La Révolution Tranquille, if you were a French speaker, you could not necessarily get a manager position, especially in my region, because there was segregation. You were not thought of as being as smart. And so I think, and this is not about rehashing the past, but I think when I hear a story, an unfortunate story like that one you went through in much details with Sylvia, it seems to me that some of those old patterns have not been broken. And we're still, despite the laws, despite the regulation, we're still operating under that mindset of colonialism and where language is assumed by the dominant culture. And this is very important for us to acknowledge as language professionals, because what we see in the U.S. is also a regression on some of the progress we had made with language accessibility, communication, and so on and so forth.
So very good point. And, you know, I talk on this channel quite a bit about the Canadian environment from a technology and from a language perspective. And I did several podcasts, you know, the latest Bill 96, etc. But for the audience, you know, who are not from Canada, who are not familiar or new to Canada, for instance, who are not familiar with the history in Canada, you know, what you see right now in a bilingual country is completely different from the time when Pascal was talking about. And it took a lot to get to where we are right now. It took a lot in changes from a government on a provincial level and on a federal level to get to where we are right now. For instance, Regulation 17 in Ontario, just to give the audience some example, Regulation 17 in Ontario, that was put together in 1912, Ontario restricted French instruction in publicly funded elementary schools. That's in 1912. So from where we are, from where we were back then to where we are right now, a lot of progress has been made. But are we perfect? I think Pascal is saying, no, we're not. We still have a lot more ways to go. And in where we are right now, where technology is affordable, people are intermingling. I think that's what I hear you saying. There's no reason why we cannot offer language infrastructure to everybody who needs it. Am I reading you correctly?
Absolutely. And when you think about it, a language infrastructure is really enabling language to coexist in a system. And everybody wins because we have several use cases now that can talk about how to build a language infrastructure, how you can improve your productivity, your ROI, your accessibility. And now more than ever, when you integrate all these AI technologies, what is it that will tip the scale for the customers or the end user? It's trust, it's relatability, rationality with the content and with each other. So we have the technology, we understand what we need to do. So we need to be able to break those old patterns and really start a new conversation to really get to that point. And here in the US, we had made a lot of progress since early 2020 with DEI. Lots of localization teams had started to team up with accessibility, UX, and to really bring together what it means to be culturally appropriate and to have that access, not just as an afterthought, but also as a matter of course. So if you can start breaking those old patterns and understand how to culturally communicate in a situation where you assume that Google Translate will be enough, then that should not happen because you understand there's several layers to a context and to a situation and so on and so forth.
You know, you bring a very valid point, like when you mentioned earlier, like the predominant culture try to impose its language on the less predominant cultures, if you will. And we use, because we are in North America, we use North American examples like Canada, United States, etc. However, throughout history, this has been present. And, you know, hundreds of years ago, and even like in the 19th century, that has taken place. And I don't mean to take people down the road of old conversations about this topic, but the Ottoman Empire, who ruled the Arabic world for 400, 500 years, tried to wipe the Arabic language. They forbid, for instance, books being printed in the Arabic language, right? But that's unsuccessful. We know, as much as people try to wipe languages by force, it doesn't happen because people hold on closer to it, becomes very intense to them, very close to their heart, and they want to save it. Half of my family is in the Quebec region, and I speak French. And when I go to Montreal, I feel like I'm going home. It feels to me that people are very traditionalist when it comes to their French language. That's number one. That's the key identity. It becomes your identity, right? So because it's threatened, right? You feel threatened from other languages. Correct me if I'm wrong. Do you feel the same? You being French from a very French town in Quebec.
Yes.
How do you feel?
I think language is part of your identity. I don't think you can separate it. And sure. While at some point I did question the Quebec government and its strict regulations around French, if the government had not, I mean, it could have been done in a better way, don't get me wrong, because I think in some cases it made it very confusing for businesses. But at the end of the day, protecting language is also protecting your identity and your culture, and it's very important. And so I don't think a language can be wiped out very easily because it's part of who you are. And as long as you remember who you are, you better understand your place in the world. So we get into a completely different realm, but that realm, when it comes to AI technologies and understanding how to deploy language at scale, we need to understand culture. We need to understand identity so that when we can properly understand that and how much people care about it, then we can create a coexisting ecosystem where hopefully communications don't break down because you are faced with somebody who doesn't speak the same language as you, but they enable you to be better at what you do.
Now, what's your view on, you know, the demographic shift? We started, you know, if you look back a little bit, not much back in history, just a little further down the history lane, Canada predominantly was English and French. Currently, you know, I receive RFPs from cities in the country that requires, for instance, translation in 100 and some odd languages. Signal to me a demographic shift in the population. How do you see that? What's your position on that?
Thank you for asking. That is a very important question that I think our industry is not addressing enough. And as I traveled to my hometown, Saguenay, recently in April, I was actually shocked to see how global it had become. Growing up, it was very homogeneous. Nobody spoke English. It was rare that you saw somebody from a different skin color. But now, today, it's completely changed. And this is happening at scale everywhere in the world. And then, so we have to start thinking about our locales as global settings as well. So we have a new global experience locally that we need to start addressing, because there's an influx of immigrants in the United States, in Europe, in everywhere. It's really shifting. So everyone is bringing a different culture, a different context. So how do we learn to coexist together? I mean, there was this old bumper sticker saying coexist in terms of religion, but now we have to think in terms of culture. How do we speak the same context to each other, even though we have different background? How do we build a future? And if we think in terms of infrastructure and break these old patterns of dominant versus dominated culture, then how do we see the beauty of language, and how do we accept each other? And it goes beyond just regulations.
Absolutely. And you know, one of the biggest things that you keep hearing everywhere, and it doesn't matter which country you're in, is with that mobility of demographics moving between countries, they talk a lot about integration, right? So you see a lot of people saying assimilation, integration, cultures, etc. You've been to large cities and you've seen, you know, every cluster of communities, they have their own cluster of communities, a community, and they probably have their own communication network. They have their own newspaper, radios, they've got their own content consumption cloud, if you will. And it's a bubble and they don't come out of that. You know, my culture is, my background is from the Middle East. So there's a Middle Eastern region here in Ontario, for instance. I know some people that they've been here like for 20, 30 years. They don't speak a word of English. Or if they did, they're speaking a little bit here and there just to get by. And by the way, to everybody, English is my third language. So you got to give me a little break on this one. So my point is, what you're talking about is very important because it helps in integration, or should we move from bilingual to multilingual as a standard for everybody?
I think we need to take a cue from nature. We need to take a cue from nature as kind of a bio design. How do we think through languages? Because you look at different species, they interact with each other, but they don't speak to each other, but they interact and they coexist. And so how do we understand each other? And is it multilingualism? Is it, how do you integrate it, not necessarily just assimilate and build new cultures together? Because the world is changing. And yes, you know, there's the host culture, but then how does that evolve over time? Because we've changed the footprint. And so I think we have a lot to learn in learning to coexist, learning to communicate and build new contexts with each other. And we need to make place for the new. Let some of those old patterns in the back. And 100%. It's scary, though, but it's scary, yeah. Because it's part of your, at the same time as you want to be open, it's also part of your identity. So how do you continue moving forward, right?
So the idea here is, take, for example, for instance, a public services, right? So healthcare, legal, those kinds of things. Everybody, citizens should have access, equal access to all these services because you live under the same government or the same municipality or whatever your territory you're in. So from that aspect, shouldn't everybody be on the same parity in your opinion?
Absolutely. We should all be able to communicate at the same level. We should have the tools, and they consult with translators, with also people in very specific industry to do some research right now to make sure that, hey, are we applying AI and technologies the right way? Because for me, it was maybe going to the hairdresser and going to the doctors were the most difficult part of learning the culture in the language in the US, for example, because, hey, how do I talk to my about my hair in a certain way? This is not something they teach you, really, like something that you have to understand. Or how do you go to the doctor and properly express what you're feeling? Because it's something that is so specific to you, yet you need the right vocabulary. Like, so how do we help level the field so that contextually we can all be on the same plane level? And that's something we need to, it's only in breaking those old patterns can we find those solution of parity for everyone in those new contexts.
So in order for us to get to that, you know, I want to call it utopia, right? So where everybody's communicating at the same level, everybody's understanding everything, that's fine, right? But there are urgent things that need to be looked at now to get there, right? Society always improving, but we have, before we get to the larger picture that we want to see in, there are many things our industry should be helping, and I think they are helping. As much as, you know, the public policy allows them in some cases, or as much as the consumer wants to get engaged in that stuff. But your point earlier that solutions are here now, but they're not being adopted widely. Why is that?
Well, there's also a big assumption from technology, like the big, and when I say technology giants, like it's the big tech, right? Because one part of, you know, their solution is to really enable communication. I mean, if you look at the history of technology, it was really to help connect people. So it seems like that narrative has just amplified. But when you look into the fine print, into the details of AI or the implementation, it's not solved. And so you need to properly lay out those solutions. So because otherwise, if you implement AI blindly, also, you're putting a veil or a mask on your identity, on your culture. And what we crave as human is being seen and in expressing our identity and as our, in our culture. How do we ensure that we use AI in language in a way that continues to express our identities, to express what we are trying to say? And yes, it will be helpful in dire situation like what we've seen in British Columbia. But if the AI algorithm sort of put a veil on some of the expression and the culture, how will be that person being able to address such a sensitive situation? So we need to be able to lay out those foundations so that AI can help us scale and go to market faster and really find a solution. But it's in the details. We have to properly lay out and use AI as an amplifier, not as a replacer of human skills. And that is a fine line. And it's going to be even more into details when we see those technologies. They're amazing. And here, this is not, I'm not anti-technology. I think it's great. However, we need to roll them out adequately to not lose the meaning, because at the end of the day is the meaning from one person to another, from one culture to another, and it cannot get lost in the algorithm filters and output that are not our voice.
That's right. And you know, you bring a very good topic, because I addressed that yesterday in my podcast that I published. I think it was this morning I published one with Vivetta. We talk about, you know, I talk about like the ability to put guardrails around AI or any technology. I mean, AI could be the tool of choice for certain people, but maybe not for some others. Whatever you're using, you need to put some guardrails or some policies around it. Because as an example, and I keep referring back to that BC case, AI could not detect, for instance, a mental condition, a mental health issue. Could not detect that. A human would. But AI would just do a straight translation. I mean, would not detect this individual is going through some psychotic episode, for instance, or some other issues they probably have. Maybe not. But AI will not be able to detect the human emotion that is driving the context of the conversation. We talked a lot about that one. November last year, I was in Saudi Arabia with some of the localization leaders who were down in Riyadh. The conversation was around, we arrived to Saudi Arabia and it was the year of the camel, for instance, right? So that's a cultural thing that is celebrated in that particular culture in Saudi Arabia. And, you know, the entire conversation around understanding the tradition and the culture of that particular country. Similarly, in North America, like whatever you are, any culture is using technology. I think we need to seek first to preserve the culture before we start translating, give me a beer or tell the Uber driver where I'm going, or why did you take the wrong street, for instance. Those are rudimentary things and you can get them from any technology, that's fine. But when it gets to a certain level of communication, I believe in my heart, I believe that technology cannot do it yet. Maybe down the road it will. It cannot. Why? Because I believe there's no way. I mean, maybe my computer science background doesn't allow me to predict down the road because technology is changing quite a bit. But as it is right now, in my opinion, in my human philosophy would tell me you cannot take the human emotion, the human tradition, the history of that emotion, where that emotion came from, grandfathers, you know, like what you were mentioning earlier, parents, etc., encapsulate it and encode it into a mathematical formula. I can't wrap my brain around that one. You cannot take that human emotion and put it in a mathematical formula because it's emotion versus science. Science is fact, 1 + 1 = 2. We have databases, we pattern, we do cross vectoring across these databases. We conclude something. This is the output that any technology will give you, AI included. But a human emotion, and if you don't have all that tradition, that history, you know, like you mentioned earlier, like, you know, my parents couldn't get a job because they didn't speak. How would AI know that? How would AI know that you're communicating with them from a point, from a position of history that affected you personally? They don't have that data.
No, they don't. And we all have each unique meaning that we bring to the world because our experience is unique. I was born in Saguenay-Lac-Saint-Jean with parents that only spoke French, and I speak from that specific experience. And all I can do is meaningfully exchange that. And AI cannot create meaning. Meaning comes from human interaction and human connection. And yes, we see some very powerful pattern recognition and output. But that meaning is essentially human. And I don't think from what I know of technologies, I could not agree more with you. It cannot be replicated just by patterns. It's about, you know, we have the patterns, but that life force, that emotion is not something that you can have solely with a formula because it is yes, you can identify some formulas around some emotions or some meanings. But that essence is still human and it cannot be replicated yet.
100%. Now, what's your take on the rush to use technology by any mean necessary versus what you and I are promoting right now is the balance between the two? You know, deploy technology, but deploy it in a thoughtful, calculated way. And yesterday on my other podcast, I said, you know, you got to make sure you insert the human professionals at the right step in the process. Where is it needed, etc. That's the most efficient way that you can use this. Because if you use one versus the other, technology versus a human, or you integrate the human early in the process or late in the process, consequences are going to be bad, generally speaking. So what's your thoughts on everybody in the world right now? You know, I get talks with people, they tell me, hey, when I put this AI application together, I say, what is it? They don't know. Why? The boss told me to put it together. I said, they have like some sort of an AI agenda and everybody's ready, rushing to do AI application, but nobody, you know, they're trying to figure out where to put AI just to check the box to say, you know, on my performance review, I did an AI application.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on this?
I think I have a bit of a rebellious opinion on that. I mean, I don't think it's the most popular opinion, but I am of the
We like rebellious opinions here. Don't worry.
I am on the side that you have to be cautious. So I think it's important that individually we do research, we understand AI technologies, and we look around for what is being built and understand what are the use cases around them. But they might not be quite yet ready yet for deployment at scale. Or are they really necessary in all use cases? And I think this is what our industry needs to ask themselves, right? Because if you think about content is not all created equal. So you can have content that's going to go through machine. And also when you think in terms of marketing, in terms of customer connection, you need to judiciously place human at the core of those tasks. So what's the best way to do that? I've been testing some writing tools using AI. I've been testing other technologies to how do you get that meaning across? And I'm not in love with any of those technologies yet, because you can translate some facet of your meaning, but it doesn't carry the whole yet. And so I think it's very important to think through that and also think through, okay, so how much are those data centers using, and are we making the most judicious decision? Because if you look at all the extra step to create marketing, for example, is it really worth it to use AI? Is it really faster? If so, in what use cases? In what use cases do you want to preserve that human specificity or that human touch, because it needs to be at the core, because that's where the meaning comes from and that's how you can really connect with someone else. So I am from a more, it's not about being cautious, but it's about understanding the impact of our choice. And, you know, there's so much noise about do AI this, do AI that. But at the end of the day, if you want to build something that is empowering growth, mutually beneficial, you need to go slowly, because it's a process over time. And it's really unpopular with corporate settings because they care about next quarter. But, you know, when you look at language, it compounds over time. So it's very important to make the right decision for future ROI. So this is the paradox of our industry. Like, if you make a very fast decision, it's not a good decision in our industry, because language grows over time, not in a fast setting. Mm-hmm. It's finding that balance between the two. And I'm not saying, oh, don't go and try. So it's about, like, how do you balance, like, okay, you deliver today, but you're still making those decisions judiciously over time.
That's right. Now, one of the things that I'd like to get your take on this one, because it's all in that language infrastructure that we started the conversation with, is that technology is enabling a lot more content to be created. We did not, you know, just take an example, for instance, and I wasn't at that meeting, but a friend of mine was in the meeting, and he told me the information. There was a meeting, a roundtable discussion hosted by the Federal Transition Bureau in Canada. And an example was thrown to the public or to the team that was there by the Bureau, saying that on an average, for instance, the Bureau used to outsource to the language industry in Canada around 350 million words per year, or used to outsource, don't know who, but used to outsource around that same number. Now, with the enabling, for instance, the automatic translation using DeepL and a few other software or technologies out there, that number has now 10 in 2025. Now, pros and cons to everything in life, I guess. Do you feel that this is the same happening in your world? Do you feel like content is being created at a rapid pace? I have like my own positive and negative to that. And the positive is that we're creating content, we're communicating more. Hopefully somebody is reading the content. The second thing is I'm feeling that, especially on the language side, and that message is for the unilingual out there that doesn't speak another language. Some of these people are creating content in a language they don't understand, and there's no way for them to judge it. And there's no way to figure out, is this good content or not? They're just saying, you want it in French? Here's it in French. Is it good French, bad French? Nobody knows. But the checkbox has been checked. I did it in French. What's your thoughts on this? Technology's there. People are using it, creating more content. But I feel like there is a less tolerance. We used to have a high bar for quality. I think that bar for quality, I don't know. I just feel like with the amount of content being created, the quality bar has been lowered. What do you think? Maybe just a feeling on my side.
I agree. It used to quality or yes. I mean, quality is, needs to be unpacked, right? Because quality is a word that means so many different things for different people. And so I think for me, quality is how do we, the impact in relation to the content based on your context, right? And so the quality will be different depending on the type of content. So a couple things here. Volume for translation. I mean, I've been in edits for over 25 years now, and it's been exponential in where you had mountains and valleys in your workload and such in the early 2000s. This is no, you're climbing Everest every week, every day. It's constant. And this is across industries. And so, but there's also a lot of content that is being created now to serve AI to help unlock the new SEO strategies and such. And so I think now we need to understand what kind of, in terms of impact and in terms of meaning, where is that meaning going? Because there's also an overwhelming, there's also a public that's being overwhelmed and they don't know what to look at anymore. So if anything, in my conversation across industry, people are searching for the meaningful content because they're being bombarded by content that is what we used to call low quality because, you know, what's the meaning? It's not attached to any meaningful engagement. And then now we're talking from one from one AI to the next, or how do you react when you get an email that you can totally see that it was written by AI and you're like, okay, this person didn't spend time writing this email and then I have to spend time reading it and responding. So how like we're in search of meaning. So how do we deploy meaning and how, so we have to start, I think we need to shift. So first, like we were saying earlier, we need to break those old patterns, but then yet now we need to think, to stop thinking just in words and start thinking in impact and meaning. How do we carry meaning in what we are trying to convey among all this noise? Quality is definitely not a good barometer. We need to rethink our rates. We need to rethink our KPIs and what's ROI when, you know, the output is created by the machine. You're not measuring the output anymore. You have to measure all the other space, right? So we have to reinvent the wheel basically. And based on what we know in the past that's worked in the fundamentals of language and communication. That's my
take. So that entire, you're right. Quality needs to be unpacked and there's many ways you can take a look at quality, but I think the industry in general has hit a slippery slope when it comes to quality and deploying technology at the same time. When we started talking about things like example, for instance, if it's for internal use, you don't have to worry about it too much. You know, you just put it through AI and that's fine. If it's for external use and somebody else is going to be reading it, and so you don't end up on the 6 o'clock news with some catastrophe by miscommunicating something, you may want to give it another layer of quality check. The slippery slope here is when we allowed one type of content or two or three, four type of contents to go into that bucket of saying, yeah, it's okay. You know what? It doesn't need a lot of scrutiny. You can just put it through machine translation or AI and Bob's your uncle. That is, in my opinion, that's the slippery slope that everybody is now worried about from the conversation I've been having.
Yes. And I agree with you, but I think this is something we need to understand that is not unique to the language industry, because if we hit a slippery slope in terms of quality expectation, it was not driven because we wanted to necessarily just cut corners, but then you have to look at the source. The source has also hit a slippery slope because, you know, when I started in my career, the level of the source was at a much higher quality level. And you could tell if there's a problem with the source, that's why the translation is so awkward. And then that started to also hit a slippery slope. So I think it's a convergence of language being more and more a commodity and not something that is intrinsically meaningful for us. So we have to, I think, extrapolate or extricate, like look at or peel off, okay, is this commodity and what's the impact? Is it engaging? Is it meaningful? Like, we have to look at the core of what is that communication purpose, in my opinion, because I think from a buyer perspective, and when you're within organization, you're being driven by some pretty drastic goals, and you see it across other industries. So it's something that we need to think through, not just as an industry, but as an overarching trend. And how do we address that?
I would say 100%. I'm agreeing with you, because it is not something that the industry brought on. This is brought on by procurement from a customer perspective. Cheaper, faster, better. And I keep telling people, you can get 2 out of 3. You know, you got to pick which 2 you want. You want it cheaper, faster or better, whatever you like. You know, it's not a 3 together, but I guess the industry keeps promising the three items together at the same time, which to a large extent, it's not right to do that, because we will not be able to deliver it. And if you deliver it, you're not delivering it consistently. Cheaper, better, faster, quality-wise better. It is really, you're promising something that you probably kind of end up faltering on, right? You may be able to do it in a couple of several occasions, but consistently deliver better, cheaper, faster, don't know how that's going to work.
It seems to me that in a time where the customers or the end user is seeking trust and reliability, mm-hmm. seeking simply cheaper and faster is counterproductive, because it's going to erode the trust that you're trying to build with your customer globally. And unless you approach it and break that pattern of dominant culture versus, you know, the oppressed culture, if you will, or the non-dominant culture, this is a pattern we need to break in order to help change the conversation and elevate the conversation. Because we made progress in the localization industry. For over 20 years, we've been able to build some strategic positioning of localization. But why, at the core of it, are we still, in many instances, it's still an afterthought? I mean, so we have to break that pattern that is unconscious when you think in terms of language.
Yeah. And the last point I want to address with you, which is very funny, actually, and so we can finish on a smiley note. So one that is just, it's always been on my mind for the past couple of weeks, is what I call the bot war. So you've got a bot who's writing the content, and you've got a bot who's translating the content. And so, and you know, take an example, for instance, you've got a bot who's writing a LinkedIn profile, who's fine tuning the LinkedIn profile. You've got a recruiter who's using a bot to sift through that. So it's bot against bot talking to each other and trying to figure out. So back to originally where we started this conversation is about being human. And now you've got bot controlling the conversations at a content creation, translation, recruiting, you know, and more of those are coming online. Those type of technologies are coming online. So we need more voices like yours and mine in the industry, where we can continue talking about plugging the human and don't forget a human. Because if you're going to end up with just pure technology delivering services or evaluating a candidate or translating for you, you are going to miss the boat on many good things that humanity still has.
Yes, I agree with you. I mean, it's such a missed opportunity, because especially in recruiting, because you know, when you recruit an employee, you recruit for potential, ideally. And you can't read between the lines when two bots are talking to each other. You cannot feel what the value or what the essence of that human is. So this is back to the point, where do we use AI and bots automatically and for commodity content? But when you think about humans, I think we've reached a point where we started to believe that humans are interchangeable, but they're not. Because if you look at the ROI of working with let's say, the same translators or the same vendors over time, productivity increased tremendously because they learn over time the context, the expertise, and all that. So I will argue that humans are not interchangeable, in that if we choose, if as a society we need to choose and we use bots to hire people, we're missing out greatly.
100%. And this is where I keep saying, like, humanity needs to play a role in this, because, you know, at the end of the day, everything can be automated to some extent, except the human emotion and compassion and all the tradition and history. You cannot automate that. But the bottom line is here is that the more we distance ourselves from being human, the risky as a humanity we are going to be becoming. And it doesn't matter what language you speak. Try any language you want. You automate something, becomes a very dry relationship, no emotions in it. Just like what you do when you deal with your ATM machine. So you go to the ATM machine, you put your card in, you want $500, and you have an insufficient fund in your ATM machine. ATM machine's not going to cry because you don't have enough fund in there. It's just got no emotion. It's going to tell you, you don't have enough fund. See ya.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, for me, I take it personally as a language professionals to promote the human. I mean, language is our part of our identity. And so 100%. How do we create the best of both worlds using these really cool technology? Because I'm not anti-technology, but I'm anti-using it the wrong way to minimize the human 100%. In us. This is my responsibility as a language professional to help articulate what is that experience of language and how can we do it better.
Responsibly using it, ethically using technology. And, you know, there are many associations here about ethical deployment of AI and the related technology, and we need to have more of them. There is that push and speed toward, you know, lowering the cost of operation for many people, for many companies, for many big enterprises, by lowering the cost of translation. And, you know, when I look at that, and having sold translation services and localization for the past 23 years, it sort of makes me laugh. And here's why. Because if you take any enterprise in the world and you ask them the question, so what is your spend on localization? And you sort them through a spreadsheet for all the items that this large organization buys, translation and localization sit at the bottom, 99.9% of the cases. So we are focusing on the lowest item in the spend to lower more cost out of it. For me, it just sounds, really? You're wasting your time on this? Let's do this one better so you can increase your revenue. Let's go through new markets where you can translate more, address more demographics, you can sell more products. Why are you focusing in on the lowest cost? Literally, I've seen some of those spreadsheets. Pascal, I'm not kidding. Some of those spreadsheets, you have a translation below the amount they bought pencils.
No kidding. I've never seen that one. That is insane.
It's crazy. And you've got an entire industry, $66 billion industry, living off the crumbs, if you will, of the rest of the industry, how much they spend. Any industry, pick one. They spend not even 1% of their cost of operation on languages.
Yes, this is why we need to break that old pattern, right? We need to be able to articulate, because we've been talking about that for years, how to elevate your strategy, how to elevate the visibility of localization. So it's really about breaking that old pattern, language is identity, and it's being able to showcase how it is mutually beneficial and also talk about the ROI the right way, because we cannot just talk about the output, because now the humans is way upstream. So how do you measure that productivity when the work is a lot more complex? So we need to have way much bigger conversation committee on that. 100%. Because yes, we're impacted for that, but all the copywriters and all the writers and content creators, they're also impacted. But we as an industry, we've been breaking down language for the past 20 years, we've been automating it. So we understand the process. So now let's flip the script and really showcase how it enables business. And those KPIs, we need to change them. And we need to stop talking about word rate, because it...
Oh my God, don't get me started on this one. I'd love to talk to you about that one, but...
That's another topic for another day.
For this industry, it was the per word rate. I don't know which genius out there decided to take a professional industry, which people go to university, studies as much as everybody else out there, and graduate and come and work for this industry and charge it at a poor word rate. I don't know which genius did that, but that was the kiss of death for this industry. We've commoditized from the get-go. Poor word rate. Imagine walking to a law firm and saying, I want to pay your lawyer on a number of words they produce on a contract. That's a conversation for a different day.
Absolutely. But it's a big one to unpack, but we have to stop because it makes no sense. As a matter of fact, I had started already 5 years ago, but yeah.
So I want to thank you for joining me. I really appreciate it. This conversation has been fun. I tell you, I had fun.
Me too.
We've talked about everything pretty much. We covered the gamut. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Great. Thank you for having me. It was a great conversation.
Thank you, Pascal. And to the audience, I want to thank you so much for joining me today on this episode. I really appreciate it. If you don't mind liking, sharing, commenting on the content that I produce, I really appreciate it. By the way, this content is only supported by me. It's not a moneymaker. I'm not making any money out of this. So I don't want somebody telling me that, hey, Robin is getting rich off of the channel. No, it isn't. And the only thing that's driving this channel is me and my passion for the industry to continue the conversation moving forward. So I want to thank everybody for listening in or tuning into YouTube or reading the blog that we produce off these episodes. So thanks so much for being part of the conversation. And I see you at the next episode. Thanks so much. Bye, everybody.